From the Vault, a true crime podcast, is a production of JPF Productions and Bebo Studios. All opinions stated are those of the podcast and its hosts and are not to be considered factual. Any facts related to today's case has been backed up by resources provided in the description for the podcast. Enjoy the show. Hello, listeners. Jason Futch here. And I want to bring to everyone's attention a very cool true crime podcast that's out there, Crime Time Nerds, a sister podcast. It is hosted by sister-in-laws Nat and Ash as they share cold cases from their home state of Vermont. But don't let that fool you, because they also talk about cases from across the United States and around the world. As a matter of fact, I was just recently a guest on their podcast as me and my colleagues from the Findlay Creek Jane Doe Task Force discussed the case of Findlay Creek Jane Doe and her unborn child that was buried in the hills of eastern Oregon in the late 1970s. Check them out. They are awesome. You can listen to them wherever you listen to your podcast. And you can also find them on Facebook and Twitter. Just type in Crime Time Nerds and they pop up right there. So go ahead, check them out. Really cool podcast, and I highly encourage everyone to listen. And thank you for listening to From the Vault, a true crime podcast. I am Jason Futch, host of this episode of From the Vault. In this episode, I will be discussing the unfortunate case of Marjorie Christina Luna. She was an 8-year-old child from Green Acres, Florida. She disappeared suddenly on May 27, 1984, after walking to Belk's General Store to purchase cat food, only 400 yards from where she lived with her mother Jenny, her mother's boyfriend Larry, and her sister Allison. Now in this episode, I am going to take a different approach with this. Instead of dragging the story out and going hours on end playing out many scenarios, my guest co-host and I will be playing for you a special documentary on this case that was released by the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office with their permission. We are going to dissect everything in this episode and also provide additional information that we collected through newspapers and videos, all the while researching this case. On that note, I want to reintroduce everyone to my guest co-host, Gwen Berenger. Hey, Gwen.
Hello.
Gwen was a co-host with me, a guest co-host on episode 4 of season 2 of True Cold Case Files, when we discussed the Multnomah County John Doe and Findlay Creek Jane Doe. I'm glad to have you back on, Gwen.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be back.
Absolutely. Gwen is actually the host of her own podcast program called A Light for Erica. It details the disappearance of Cave Junction missing woman Erica Renee Hogue, who disappeared out of Selma, Oregon in 2018, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. And I remember we had a really lengthy discussion on Erica when we last spoke. Are there any updates to her case so far?
Unfortunately, not really. Currently, I'm going on hikes with people, hoping to find something that leads me to her and taking in tips that I've been receiving. There have been a few possible sightings, but nothing that's really panned out thus far. However, I've been getting a lot of people interested in the case, and I do consider that a pretty big improvement from where it was, you know, nobody really being familiar with her face.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and with adult missing persons cases, as I've discussed in the past, they're not necessarily emphasized on unless they are special needs or something specific is going on with them that they've disappeared with some kind of foul play intended. And it's unfortunate that missing adult cases are not taken as seriously as missing children's cases, as we will learn in this episode of From the Vault. With Erica's case, there definitely needs to be some kind of special attention, because if I remember correctly, she's got some special issues that she was going through, right?
Yeah, she's schizophrenic, and that definitely put kind of a high alert on her case.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, that does not seem to be the case, as her case was, it hasn't been closed, but it's definitely inactive as of October 2019.
So basically, it's in law enforcement purgatory at the moment.
Until they get some sort of substantial lead, they're not really looking into anything, and it's kind of up to the community to find something.
Yeah, that's very unfortunate. And hopefully with everything that you're doing on the podcast and your public information regarding her case, hopefully something will come together. Maybe she'll be alive and she's not realizing that there's somebody looking for her, or, you know, unfortunately something bad may have happened to her, but let's hope that she's still doing all right. She's just in a place in her life right now where she's really not listening to anybody.
And regardless of her circumstances, I feel like bringing her home to her loved ones is first and foremost.
I agree. And same goes for this person we're about to be talking about here, Christy Luna. And it's very unfortunate because even though these two cases are night and day, they're still missing people. And regardless of their ages, circumstances, situations going on with their lives, they should still be able to go home. Unfortunately, in one of these cases, the case we're covering today, as the years continue to go on, there's starting to be less hope in locating Christy Luna. Because you have to keep in mind, she disappeared in 1984. That's almost 40 years. That's really, yeah, as time goes on, it's going to be really difficult to try to locate her.
With older cases especially, you have to take into consideration that a lot of the people involved in the case are also getting old.
Oh, yeah. We'll learn that here because one of the lead detectives on this case, he's up there in age as well. The longer he's worked on this case, the more personal this case has become for him. As we'll learn later in the video that we're going to be playing. With that being said, Nick is not going to be with us for a couple of episodes because he's been pretty busy, hard at work, working on this next episode that we're planning on doing together, and that's going to be on the Amy Mihaljevic cold case homicide. And he's working on one hell of an episode. In fact, he's already lined up a very special guest. It's an insider in that case. A lot of people are going to be pleased by what we produce out of that. So stay tuned really soon. We'll keep you guys updated on dates and times when that happens. In the meantime, Gwen will be filling in for him. And like I said, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. And it's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
It's just nice to be involved with something that seems to be doing something, creating a discussion. I love it.
And you know, last year, there was some heavy, heavy media attention on Christy's case because it marked 34 years since Christy disappeared. And once again, folks, she disappeared 400 yards from where she lived. That's not a really far walk at all. Like, you could see her house from the store and vice versa. This is just one of the most complex cases I've ever had to report on. You know, writing this episode, I found it very difficult and at times energy consuming trying to get all the information in this episode because there's a lot of information that is provided.
It's very confusing, and there's quite a few persons of interest, you know, as we will later learn, who have something potentially to do with this. There's a lot of just random, you know, things involved that just don't make a lot of sense when it comes to this disappearance.
Oh, absolutely. Without further ado, I am going to kind of explain how we're going to do this. This documentary, it was produced by the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office last year. It was released on May 27th of 2019, 34 years to the day she disappeared. It's a 20-minute documentary, but what we're going to do for you is at key points, we're going to stop the audio, and Gwen and I are going to discuss it, and also we're going to provide additional information regarding some of this information that has been provided to us by Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office. Some of the voices you're going to be hearing in this documentary, aside from the narrator, who is not me, by the way, is going to be the voice of Jenny Johnson, who is Christy's mom. You're also going to be hearing from Detective William Springer, who was the lead detective in this case on behalf of the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office. These are going to basically be the two main characters in this case that you're going to be hearing from. From there, we'll be talking about those specific aspects of the investigation, and then we'll go from there. So, with that being said, are you ready to get a crack at it, Gwen?
Let's do it.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. So, we're going to go ahead and start it from the beginning for you all. If you want to kind of like watch the video, the documentary, we'll have the link available in the description box on this episode. So that way, after you listen to this episode, you can actually watch the video and see some of the things that the detective's talking about, like where he's pointing out the distance between Christie's house and the store and stuff like that. So without further ado, we'll go ahead and play.
It rained for 10 days and 10 nights straight after she went missing. It was a Sunday afternoon, May 27th, 1984. Eight-year-old Marjorie Christie Luna left home to go to the corner store only a few blocks away and never returned.
Anybody that has a child and you've like turned your back for a second and you can't find them, like you're at a store, your home, or and that feeling that, you know, going crazy, where is it? Imagine living that for 33 years. It's very hard.
Christie disappeared around 2:30 p.m. that Sunday afternoon. It was Memorial Day weekend. She left her Green Acres home to get cat food for her newborn kittens, Boo Boo and Skeeter. The corner store she frequented, Belk's General Store, was only two blocks away from her house, exactly 400 feet away. It was a trip Christie made on a regular basis.
And this is Belk's store. And Christie's house was right in here.
You ready?
Yeah.
I'm Detective William Springer, Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office, Violent Crimes Division, Cold Case Unit. Christie Luna was at home with her mother, Jenny, her sister, Allison, and live-in boyfriend, Larry Jackson. They had taken a road trip the night before and went up to Central Florida and came down A1A and US 1 and stopped at several parks on the way down. The last one being Dubois Park.
I was tired because I had driven all night, and Allison, my other daughter, was awake with me. Christie had slept, you know, part of the night. So she was wide awake, but I took her, she wanted Wendy's Happy Meal. So I took her over there and got her a Happy Meal and came back and decided I was going to lay down and rest. And so I put her on Yellow Submarine by the Beatles, that movie, cartoon movie.
In the town.
Yeah, so that is the beginning of some real shitty things to come. Wouldn't you agree, Gwen?
Absolutely. And I already have a question.
Yeah.
I don't want to jump too far ahead, but I do find it interesting that the lead detective pointed out their route before everything occurred and before they made it back home, and also mentioned that they stopped at a few locations on the way back. Mm-hmm. Now, my question would be, I'm wondering how feasible it would be for someone to have potentially followed them from one of these locations.
You know, and that's a very good question, and I'm not necessarily sure that's been addressed before in this case, but like if it has, it wouldn't be surprising because we don't have the police documents in front of us to be able to examine all the leads, like every single lead, every single tip that's come into the sheriff's office or even to the Greenacre City Police Department. But I will say that it wouldn't be surprising because in certain cases, there have been situations where families were stalked by killers or kidnappers, potential suspects.
And that way they could have an idea of where they live, how they live. And in this situation, considering that they were traveling during Memorial Day weekend up to Central Florida and back, especially that beach, especially Du Bois Park, like that would be very easy for somebody to just like look around, find the perfect family that might have some kind of lax, like they're really lax on, they would definitely find easy targets there, if you will. Let's just put it that way, an easy target. But it would not be surprising if the suspect followed around. You know, it'll definitely get a little more clearer. But as we continue on with this case, there's going to be more revelations that come up, especially early on in this investigation where two suspects are immediately identified. Well, I shouldn't even say suspects, but more like persons of interest.
Let's not jump ahead of ourselves now.
Yeah, let's not do that. But anyways, we're going to go ahead and continue on with the video. And let's see what else they have in store for us here.
Mama Kitty that had babies, and she thought she was hungry, so she decided to go to the little store, which is 400 feet from my front door, in a country town, and she made it there to get the cat food, but she never made it back home.
Jenny, Larry, Allison, and Christy all laid down to take a nap after they got something to eat. Later in the afternoon, Christy got up and told her mother that she needed to go to the store to get cat food because they didn't have any cat food for their cat. Don't wait. As you can see, right down here, you can see it from the corner is Bilk's store. Your eye distance from the corner to the house and from the corner to Belk's store is eye distance. It's not that far.
Sunday afternoon, Memorial Day weekend. Back at a time when all the kids rode their bikes around the blocks. There was no cable TV. There wasn't internet, cell phones, or anything like that.
Little Christy, only weighing 60 pounds, walked barefoot. Wearing a turquoise jumpsuit and carrying a few empty plastic bottles, she planned to exchange for money. A grocer remembers selling the cat food to Christy between 2:30 and 3 p.m. After calling a few of Christy's friends and knocking on a few doors, the police were notified at 10:15 p.m. that night, and they have been searching for her ever since.
So here we go. So basically, we're coming down to the meat and bones of this investigation, or should I say the start of it anyways. 8:30 p.m. rolls around. Allison wakes up, which is Christy's sister. She wakes up, notices Christy's gone, gives it a little bit. She still doesn't return. Wakes mom up. Mom's knocking on doors, making phone calls. And then suddenly, with no answers, she calls the Green Acre City Police. The narrator says that she disappeared around 2:30 in the afternoon. In most reports, it's 3 p.m. But nonetheless, that's a big span of time between the time she left the house and the time she was reported missing. That's a lot of time to have to fill in.
And also, I want to point out, she was barefoot and not that far away from her house. So there's not really much reason why she on her own would have been that late. So, I mean, good on her family for getting the ball rolling as far as that was concerned as quickly as possible.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's going to take a big group effort here to try to locate Christy Luna here. You know, we're talking about involvement from multiple agencies, nonprofit organizations, and getting her face in the newspaper in the South and also in the rest of the state of Florida. It's going to be a big effort on law enforcement and the family's part to make sure that Christy is found. As we find out in this upcoming bit of audio we're about to play, some suspects start to arise as well. So we'll go ahead and continue the video. A lot of this information that you're going to be hearing shortly is going to contain information that might not be suitable for children. So if you're under the age of 18 and you did not get parental permission to listen to this episode, we do request that you move along. Otherwise, if you think you can handle it, go right ahead, continue listening, but please be warned, there will be some information here that will be unsettling. So we'll go ahead and play the audio a little more.
In 1984, no cell phones, no databases. The computer really wasn't a thing that everybody had back then. I don't even know if they even had computers. I mean, we had our computers that we used at work, but nothing like personal computers. So we had no databases. Everything we learned was through neighborhood canvases and just getting out and doing the footwork door to door.
The case was first investigated by Detective Sergeant Dennis Connell of the Green Acres Police Department. He and his team of three detectives knocked on doors and interviewed over 50 people for 2 weeks straight. Most of those interviewed were children and adults who were in the neighborhood the day Christy vanished. With those interviews, Detective Connell learned Christy could have possibly stayed at the store till 6 p.m. playing arcade video games or even head out to a nearby park frequented by kids in the neighborhood.
Okay, I just want to point out how weird it is to me that they conducted interviews and nobody could actually pinpoint where they had last seen Christy. Like, none of the neighborhood kids or anything. Like, didn't this girl have friends?
Again,
she was barefoot and she had kittens to go home to. And she seemed like she was awfully worried about getting these kittens their food. So what reason would she have to go to a nearby park?
Right.
She was without shoes, worried about her kittens. Like, that just doesn't make any sense to me as far as an investigative lead goes. I get that you have to follow all leads, but that just seems like it was both.
Yeah, and that's what I get too sometimes when I hear that. It's like, you know, she seemed to have been in some kind of like hurry, you know. I mean, the thing is that, you know, if she was planning on being out for a long period of time, you would think she'd put her shoes on. But the way she was dressed, it seemed like she was ready to go back home after she was done at the grocery store. She was just basically going in and going out. I mean, it's like, you know, a woman going to Walmart in her PJs. Do you really think she's going to go swing by a bar later on or right afterwards or go dine in at a restaurant in that outfit? No, of course not. Well, I mean, I guess it depends on who you are, but like, it's
in my town, maybe not so much in some like classier places though. Let's be real.
Yeah. If I'm going to Walmart to grab something real fast, it doesn't require me to take a 30-minute shower and put on something nice. I'm just going to go as is. And in this case, you know, I think Christy's intention was to just go to the store, get some cash for the bottles she had, purchase some cat food, and then head on home, get these cats fed, and then whatever happened after happened. But here we are, you and I, Gwen, having this discussion 35 years after all this went down. This conversation should not be happening right now.
Again, like, why wasn't anybody in that area able to actually pinpoint, you know, Christy's, you know, whereabouts or anything like that? She may have gone to the park. Like I said, didn't she have any sort of, like, friends, any acquaintances, anyone who was familiar enough with her just existing in that area who saw her that day? Especially since they were so quick to jump on this case.
Well, yeah, I know she had a number of childhood friends. And the thing is that she definitely had a lot of friends in the area. She was always seen playing, you know, video games at Belk's, or she was going to the park, which I think that's where those leads derived from. Because, you know, sometimes I'll say it like this. Sometimes children say the darnest things. Sometimes a memory from yesterday may seem like today to them. And they might have seen Christy go out somewhere a couple of days ago and was referring to that, maybe. One of the more promising leads that I heard was the arcade angle, which, you know, came from the store clerk, Miss Belk. And so we'll actually learn a little bit about that in this video, but I do want to touch up on that too. She was last seen possibly playing video games at the store till about 6 p.m. And I noticed in one of the newspaper articles from the Palm Beach Post, there was a little discussion where the store clerk had also mentioned that at 6 p.m., she left with the other kids out of the store. She was actually seen with other children leaving the store. So I also wonder, too, if that was kind of what derived the whole park theory.
But then we also have them saying, possibly. Like, mm-hmm. did the grocer see her? Or did the grocer not see her?
Right.
You know, I mean, I get that as somebody who works in retail, the days do sometimes blend together, mm-hmm. and the children that you may see do sometimes blend together. But it's
right.
It's Memorial Day weekend. Christy and her family were apparently gone for some length of time prior to then. So even if she was a regular at Belk's, you know, they wouldn't have seen her for a few days prior to then. I would think that perhaps that day would have stuck a little bit more firmly in somebody's memory.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that statement, especially if she was a regular, you know, you would think, okay, well, let's see what's going on here. You know, I feel like Christy, considering some of the features that we talked about with her, stand out in a crowd of children, wouldn't you think?
Yeah. Let's give a quick description of what she looked like to the audience, though, because they mm-hmm. haven't necessarily seen her. I know that they mentioned that she was only 60 pounds.
Yep.
And brown hair, or is it blonde?
Hold on a second. Brown hair.
Brown hair, okay.
So yeah, like on that note, let me go ahead and run down some of Christy's vitals here. She was 4 feet and she weighed only 60 pounds. She was only wearing a turquoise bodysuit and she had no socks on, no shoes, nothing on. And it's very important to also notice that she is hearing impaired. She is a white female with brown hair, hazel eyes, and she has a strawberry birthmark on the right side of her back near her hip. And she also had a scar on her right arm, as well as a scar on her ring. And she also had a slight speech impediment, and her teeth are crooked. I mean, that was some of the basic information that I located on the Charlie Project, which is a great website, by the way. Also, side note, shout out to Megan Good. Congratulations on your wedding. Hope you're doing well. But yeah, that's the information that I received here on Charlie Project. And it's just amazing. She disappeared suddenly. Like, yeah, you're right. You definitely have a point here that a lot of probablys and not a definite. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there's no definitive sighting other than she went to the store to pick up cat food.
Mm-hmm.
And she did wake her mother up, though, to tell her mother she was going to the store, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so we do know for sure. The one thing we do know is that she was intending on going to the store for cat food. And after that, we don't really know. Because it seems like nobody was paying attention to the little hearing-impaired girl with crooked teeth.
Mm-hmm. And barefoot.
Yeah, I'm sorry. This just, like, this irritates me. Honestly, because like I don't even necessarily like children that much, and if a child wanders into my shop, I am on them like a hawk, making sure that, you know, they're okay. If there is not an adult around, I'm like, hey, where's your person?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I mean, some people might say, okay, this was the 80s. And in mm-hmm. the 80s, you know, children were allowed to, you know, go out and do things a little bit more freely.
Sure.
But we also have to remember that the 80s was the days of Johnny Gosch. Johnny Gosch went missing in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. And Adam Walsh.
Yeah, and those missing persons cases were quite high profile, and people were kind of getting the inclination of, oh, maybe we should actually keep an eye on children when we see them out in places randomly.
Right.
So for the store clerk not to be able to give any sort of clear answer one way or the other, or to just flip-flop, it seems really weird to me.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I don't want to come down too hard on them, honestly. I don't want to make it seem like it's all their fault necessarily, because, you know, there were other people in the store. You have to figure at least one person saw Christy that day and made note of the fact that she was actually there.
Mm-hmm.
And may have seen her leave.
Right. And, you know, as we get a little deeper into this, too, there are some definites that do come out, which it was Christy being seen with one of the persons of interest. Yeah. And we'll talk about that here in just a minute, because actually we're starting to get close to that. But yeah, like as you were just talking about, this was the days of stranger danger and protecting your children and, you know, making sure that they're okay and they shouldn't be talking to random people on the street. Sometimes, and I'm not necessarily going to start throwing arrows at people, but damn, you know, regardless of the house being close to Belk's general store, she still should have been supervised going to the store. I hope I'm not being too harsh about that.
I'm sure that her mother probably holds an immense amount of regret for not going with her that day, for allowing her to go off on her own that day.
Sure. Yeah, and
I wouldn't doubt it for a minute.
Yeah, and you know, like I said, I'm not necessarily blaming her for it. Definitely would not blame the mom, because like we've been talking, it was different times. The whole notion of stranger danger wasn't necessarily like a big thing until about the mid-80s. On that note, though, I had just name-dropped a murder victim, Adam Walsh. That happened not that far from where Christy disappeared. He disappeared in Broward County, Florida, in Hollywood, in 1980. And he was murdered, you know, by Otis Toole. So, you know, you would think that with his murder, there would be a little more emphasis on protecting your children in South Florida. So, with that being said, we're going to go ahead and move forward with the video, and we're going to be starting to move into a couple of interesting things. We'll go ahead and let the video do some talking.
Days after the investigation began, the Green Acres Police Department realized they needed more resources to find Christy. That is when they called the FBI and the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office.
I was one of the original detectives on the case in 1984. There was a supervisor, John Kianka was the supervisor, and I want to say two other detectives, Adonu Gliano and Mark Bannon, and myself worked on the case, along with the Green Acres detectives and the FBI agents. We had two suspects that were arrested for molesting Christy's best friend, who she was going to go see. Those two suspects were Charles and Willis Rambo.
The Rambo brothers lived at 353 Broward Avenue, only a few houses up from Christy's.
A team assigned to interviewing Christy's friends, going to the elementary school, interviewing her friends at school, her teachers and things. During the course of that investigation, one of Christy's closest friend was interviewed, and it was discovered that Willis and Chuck Rambo were molesting her friend. This team put together a probable cause for the arrest of Chuck and Willis and a search for their house. It was established that Christy had gone to the Rambo residence. Chuck and Willis were both interviewed and denied any involvement in the disappearance of Christy. A search was conducted of their house and their property, and no investigative leads could be developed as far as Christy being murdered at that house.
According to Ellen Belk, a clerk at Belk's store, she had seen Charles giving Christy money on one occasion at the store. A week later, police charged the second Rambo brother, Willis, for sexual battery after the six-year-old girl told police Willis had also molested her and tried having sex with her one time.
Those are some weird-looking motherfuckers right there.
Backwards-looking fools.
Yeah, so we just got our definite right there. Probably one of the only definites we're going to get in this case.
But it's not even a definite as to the day that she disappeared. You noticed that they said that she was at the Rambo brothers' house, but they didn't really say when.
Mm-hmm. Well, from what I understand, too, so even, and you're not going to really hear this in the video, but if you dug into the newspapers on newspapers.com, you'll notice that there's a lot of stories pertaining to the Rambo brothers. And Willis and Chuck Rambo, yes, they lived together in this home in Green Acre City. Two young men at the time, anyways. And apparently children were going over to their houses, to their house, which in itself is fucking weird. Why would children be going to two grown men's houses, you know? It's...
Want some candy?
Exactly, you know, the whole Herbert the pervert scenario there. It's really freaking strange. I mean, so, I'm going to add a personal note here. So I used to be friends when I was about 14, 15 years old. I was friends with a 65-year-old man. And at the time, you know, people thought it was weird. My, you know, the people who watched over me thought it was weird. The church parishioners that I went to church at, he went to the same church, by the way. They all thought it was weird. And in fact, I remember one time the priest, Father Hugh, he came up to me and asking me questions. Basically, you know, asking me shallow questions, trying to see if he can insinuate any kind of child molestation happening towards me. No, not at all. There was no hanky-panky going on between me and this 60-something-year-old man. But everyone looked down on my relationship with my friend. And I was a good friend of his until he passed away from cancer about 10 years ago. And, you know, in this situation, though, so it's very different, though, because we're talking about children, like elementary school-age children, going to the house of two 30-something-year-old men. Like, what the fuck?
You gotta wonder kind of what he was offering these children. Was it just about the money? Like, is this particular area of Florida, like, kind of destitute at this point or something?
Like, well,
children really wanting, you know, that much extra freaking pocket money?
You got to also remember, too, back in the day, you know, they didn't have internet, they didn't have cell phones, you know, they didn't have access to video games easily. So what I was thinking is perhaps they were that desperate to get pocket change, to play these arcade games or to have a good time. Because back in 84, you could probably get a pocket, a stick of gum. You could probably get a burger real cheap. I mean, you could probably get food real cheap and play video games for only a nickel. I bet you that might be one of the reasons why, but it's really hard for me to explain because I was not a child of the 80s. I wasn't even born then. Hearing stories from people that did come from that era, yeah, I really don't know. But that this part of Florida right here, Green Acres City, wasn't even really that bad of a... It's not that bad of a town. Like, it's not even run down. So we're going to let the narrator take over from here and just talk about the Rambos for a minute, and then we'll get back to them here in just a second. So go ahead and take a listen.
The judge working the case had a problem with the sexual battery charges against the Rambo brothers, stating the statements from the six-year-old girl would be inadmissible in court. The charges were dropped and the brothers pleaded guilty to a lesser charge of lewd assault. They were placed on probation for 10 years after serving a few months in jail. In 1993, Willis Rambo was sentenced to 4 life terms for sexually abusing his 2 stepdaughters. He is now serving life in a Florida prison. Charles, although arrested for molesting Christie's friend and convicted of lewd assault, was never registered as a sex offender. Prior to 1994, there was no federal law governing sex offender registration and notification in the United States. He now resides in Lenore City, Tennessee.
Understand what the narrator just said, folks.
What a couple of creeps.
The thing about this is that, yeah, these two are eloped in some kind of, like, sexual fantasy toward children, apparently. And it's definitely a disgusting factor, especially when you pair in the fact they got a slap on the wrist for this.
Well, one of them did, at least. Other one at least got convicted later on down the line for a separate offense. It just really sucks that it took a separate offense.
We also have to remember, you know, their house was searched and everything in between. There was no evidence to link the Rambo brothers to Christie. There was no evidence to necessarily link them to some kind of major sexual assault against these children. But, like, the police probably could tell, though, that there was something going on here with the brothers, which is why they still got charged with lewd assault and they still served 10 years of probation in regards to this situation with Christie's friend. And then, well, later on down the line, Willis Rambo gets convicted of, you know, sexual assault towards two minors, which were related to him.
His stepdaughters. Those are children that he's supposed to be taking care of, for God's sake.
Right now, as we're recording this episode of From the Vault, Willis Rambo, he's still sitting in, he's still sitting in a Florida prison right now in South Florida. So, like, it's really difficult to also fathom the fact that Charles Rambo is free, walking around in Tennessee, living a new life, basically.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
At least regarding what we were talking about before you started recording and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever considered the possibility of reaching out to Willis Rambo?
Yes, I did. You know, I really wanted to talk to him about that. I haven't been able to really do any kind of correspondence lately, obviously, because of the position I'm in at the moment, you know, doing this truck driving gig. But it definitely has crossed my mind to talk to at least one Rambo brother. If I can't get to Willis, somehow I could probably get to Charles. Would Charles want to talk to me? That's a completely different question.
Exactly. But why I'm thinking that Willis would be the better option. He's the one that has an abundance of free time right now.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting thought. And I may actually pursue that. So if at some point in the future we may have, well, we might actually have a special guest on the show.
A follow-up episode.
We'll keep everybody posted if we can make that work, because, yeah, that'd be something I'd like to do, because, you know, it'd be nice to get pretty much everyone's side of the story. And as we're going to be learning here in just a few minutes, there's going to be another suspect in this case. And I have a feeling you and I are going to be talking a lot about him, actually, once his name is revealed and, you know, the narrator gives us a little bit more information about this guy. And unfortunately, in this guy's situation, he's dead already. We can't really talk to the dead like that unless, you know, we do a seance and all that good stuff. But you know, we'll kind of fill everybody in on that in just a minute. But in the meantime, let's go ahead and let the narrator talk a little more and lead us into our next subject.
But the Rambo brothers were not the only suspects in the case.
Green Acres got information from Exeter, New Hampshire Police Department that a subject by the name of Victor Wynetti had been developed as a suspect in the disappearance of a girl in Exeter, Tammy Belanger. At that point, Green Acres and Exeter PD and the FBI were looking at Victor as a potential suspect in the disappearance of Christy Luna, because he had relatives, family, his parents, who lived not too far from the city of Green Acres.
Wynetti was a golf course worker who moved to Florida from New Hampshire in 1984. He was reported partying in Christy's neighborhood the day she disappeared, but moved to New Hampshire a short time after Christy went missing. When he moved back to Palm Beach, police from New Hampshire disclosed that inmates in a New Hampshire prison told him that Wynetti had confessed to abducting, raping, and then killing both Christy and Tammy back in 1984. When asked about it, Wynetti denied knowing Christy. he was sentenced to 75 years. Under the conditional release program, Game Time, one year he was let out of prison in April 2012.
Victor was released from prison, immediately moved to back to Palm Beach County. When he moved to Palm Beach County, our TAC team did a 24-hour day surveillance on Victor for probably 30 days. And they photographed Victor looking in the windows of various homes. It was established that the windows he was looking into were the bedrooms of minor children. They observed him standing outside these bedroom windows masturbating. That time he was arrested and charged with various about crimes in Palm Beach County. And he was sent to prison. And finally got out of prison, I want to say 2009. Once he got out, he was out of prison for probably a year, living in the Ocala area, and subsequently died of natural causes.
Victor Juanetti, that's the next suspect we're going to be talking about. You know, he was working at this golf landscaping place nearby. Well, basically, it was this golf course. And he happened to be in the neighborhood the day that Christy disappeared. He just happened to be in the neighborhood the day Christy disappeared. Months later, Months later, he goes up to New Hampshire. And then this other girl, Tammy Belanger, disappears. And a little bit more about Tammy. You know, she was last seen walking to Lincoln Street School in Exeter, New Hampshire on November 13th of 1984. Note, the same year Christy went missing. A neighbor saw her cross Court Street at approximately 8 a.m., but she never arrived at the school. She's never been seen again, and she was not reported as a missing child to law enforcement until after the school day ended, as Lincoln Street School did not verify student absences until after her disappearance. Now, it's just it's a very interesting situation because at this same time, Victor Juanetti was actually seen in the same area where Tammy disappeared, driving this blue beat-up vehicle, and his car was seen in the area the day she disappeared. He was known to hang out with minors and have sex with them, according to some of these newspaper articles I read. Apparently, some of his coworkers knew that he had an obsession with underage girls, and apparently there were occasions where he was having sex with them in this RV he lived in out there, and eventually he went to prison. It was a robbery charge, if I'm not mistaken. He goes to prison, and then he's confessing to inmates at this said prison that he killed Christy and Tammy.
Did he not get, shanked in prison? Because, to my knowledge, prisons have pretty strict, guidelines within the inmate population.
Right.
About, women beaters, child killers, child rapists.
In some situations, I'm sure there's inmates who feel very comfortable around other inmates that they don't mind sharing some of these intimate details with them, because they know that they're not going to get attacked, they're not going to say anything else to other inmates, stuff like this. But the way it sounded, though, it sounded like he was pretty open about it, about the whole situation. He talked to the inmates about it and stuff like that. But yeah, I do kind of find it surprising that he didn't get killed because of this. And yeah, so I mean, Victor Juanetti's name is going to come up quite a few times in this investigation. I believe, personally, that a lot of people still consider him the prime suspect in this case, even though he's never been charged with Christy's disappearance or Tammy's disappearance for that matter. Now, he is eventually released from prison and he moves back down to South Florida and he goes back to his landscaping job at the golf course. And then as we just listened to Detective Springer say, as soon as he got back down south, detectives had him followed and they were able to do some kind of a joint mission with the Exeter Police Department out of New Hampshire. They had a detective from New Hampshire come down and work with investigators to follow this man around, see what the hell he does in his free time. The man is a peeping Tom, going to these different houses, peeping through windows where minor children sleep and do whatever in their rooms. And here he is, pardon the expression, jerking off while he's watching these kids sleep or doing whatever it is they were doing in the room. It takes investigators 30 days to arrest this man. So here's my big question, though, Gwen, is why did they even let this guy do that for so long? I mean, after maybe one or two incidences, wouldn't you think that would be the moment to grab him and send him to jail instead of him victimizing more minors for a whole month?
Well, my only thought in regards to that, and the only way that I possibly could see them allowing this, would be if they were just hoping that he was going to try something similar to what he potentially done to Tammy or Christy. They were probably waiting until they had something more solid to charge him with. Mm-hmm. In relation to that, something, you know, more severe that would potentially get him locked up for more time, because there would be no real logical explanation as to why that would occur. But I mean, from an investigative standpoint, if you want the maximum amount of evidence against somebody, you have to watch them for quite a long while.
Sure.
I mean, watching might not always be pretty.
Yeah. I mean, I guess they have to build their case up and stuff like that. They have to build up the information and intel so that way they can make sure they can get him in prison for a long time.
For example, there's a case from Long Beach, California that I have been studying kind of on the down low. And the person of interest in that case admitted to potentially hiding this missing person's body, disposing of it, and he never got charged with anything. And the only reason that I could necessarily see this going down is because they were waiting for him to slip up and for something else to occur.
It's just amazing that sometimes, like, when you observe what police did or are doing in certain cases, it's like, why did they let this go on for so long? But then you realize that they're trying to build their case against said person. But then sometimes you see in certain situations, like, I'll give an example as well. There's a cold case homicide out of Tallahassee, Florida. Covered this in season one of True Cold Case Files way back when, Dorothy Blanchard Thomas. And it's publicly known that they have a suspect in this case. It's publicly known, but the suspect's never identified. What are they waiting for? Are they doing intel on this guy? The guy must be like a million years old now, because Dorothy was murdered in 1958. So I'm like, why are we waiting so long to get a suspect arrested here? Are we waiting for him to slip, like throw a solo cup in a trash can so they can get some DNA out of it? Or are we waiting on him to kill somebody else? Why are we letting a known suspect walk the fucking streets after he brutally killed somebody? I mean, Dorothy was stabbed 27 times in a dry cleaning store and left to die in a bathroom, only to be found by a Coca-Cola delivery driver that morning. So I'm like, why would you let someone who brutalized a woman continue to walk free?
We also have to keep in mind, unfortunately, that having a suspect isn't the same as having a, you know, viable person of interest necessarily. It's not the same as being able to convict. So it's it's entirely possible that even though he has been a suspect for all of these years, he's kept his nose clean enough that they haven't been able to get any evidence to convict. You know, I mean, there's a bunch of true crime cases kind of where, you know, such things have happened. For example, the Alyssa Turney case, the Phoenix PD twiddled their thumbs on that for so freaking long. She went missing in 2001. And they twiddled their thumbs up until this year before finally arresting her stepfather.
Yeah.
And I still believe that they wouldn't have done that if it hadn't been for Alyssa's sister fighting to get her father convicted.
You know, in the Turney case, you know, yeah, her sister was loud, which, you know, law enforcement, well, depending on what agency you're getting loud at, they might not like that too much. And then they get annoyed and irritated. but who gives a damn about how they feel? At the end of the day, you've got to really keep pounding into law enforcement that these cases should never be forgotten, especially like in a case like Christy Luna's, where it's been getting close to 40 years. But the good thing about this one is that the sheriff of Palm Beach County, Rick Bradshaw, he has been a stickler on this case since he was sheriff. Like, he's been on this case since day one. I gotta hand it to him. He runs a really tight ship down there in Palm Beach County, making sure that these cold cases are not forgotten.
But making sure that they're not forgotten and making sure that they're actively being worked on are unfortunately two different things. And I just want to point that out because, you know, you can have a whole community of people raising awareness.
Newspaper digging and...
You can have a whole community of people raising awareness.
Yeah.
It's really, at the end of the day, that only does so much. At the end of the day, sure, it is up to the investigators.
Yep. And yeah, and where I was going with that was that, you know, they the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office, they're definitely doing their jobs. And I think it's pretty much good enough for me anyways. And you guys will kind of understand that as we move along, because Christy's case has been given special treatment by the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office because of how long it's taken for investigators and people to find her, and the fact that her mom is still alive, hoping that she'll come home soon. As we're going to learn later, Jenny Johnson still lives in the same house where Christy lived when she disappeared. It's really sad, a real sad situation here. And I really hope that, you know, there is resolution in this case. But concerning Lunetti, though, I feel like this is our guy here. I truly think this is our guy, in my opinion.
It would certainly seem like he would be one of the most plausible leads, despite the Rambo brothers being familiar to Christy.
I mean, what are the odds? What are the damn odds of you being near two missing children's disappearances? And on top of that, being seen near where they were last seen as well.
And being a damn pedophile to top it all off. Come on.
Exactly. What are the fucking odds on that one? And I don't blame Jenny's reaction, you know, when she was in the courtroom the day they sentenced him to that 75 years in prison. She started screaming at this guy saying, "You killed my daughter. Where is my daughter?" You know, she was really, really upset with this man, because I think she knows too. This is the suspect. This is the guy who potentially murdered her daughter.
I just wish that he'd lived long enough to be able to say something, be able to confirm or deny one way or the other. Maybe he left something behind after he died that could point us to where Christy is, and it just hasn't been found yet.
I kind of hope that would be the case, but it sounds like that while he was in prison in the state of Florida, he kept his mouth shut about the case. I don't think he went around like he did in New Hampshire bragging about, yeah. And my thing is, I wonder how Jenny Johnson reacted the day he was released from prison.
I would not imagine that she reacted well.
He ended up moving up to Ocala area, to the Ocala, Florida area. And that's actually not far from where I live in Lake City. That's only an hour's drive from where I live. It's very interesting because I wonder what brought him to Ocala, because a lot of his life was spent down in the Lake Worth area of Florida, which is South Florida. Yeah, I just kind of wonder about that. And where did he live? What kind of housing did this guy have prior to him dying? Like,
He burnt enough bridges in the area that he was from regarding, you know, diddling children and shit like that, that it was just time for a change of pace.
I wonder if he knew he was dying.
I hope not.
So you kind of hope it was like one of those hidden cancers and he was just like in pain all the time?
Yeah, and he just spent his life wondering, is this my karma?
Yep. I mean, it's very unfortunate that he's dead, because, I mean, if he killed Christy, you can't necessarily say he is the definite suspect, because we don't have that kind of proof, but he is allegedly a person of interest in this investigation. But if he is the main culprit, the suspect, the man who is responsible for both of these girls' disappearance, I just wonder what kind of secrets he took to the grave with him.
you know, and that's really just something that only that would be between him and whatever gods out there, I suppose.
Very, very unfortunate. But in my opinion, though, you know, after listening to this and reading what I've read in the paper, it makes sense that he would definitely be prime suspect in this case. But he's not the only suspect in this case. Well, I mean, you know, you have the Rambo brothers, of course, but we've already kind of low-key ruled them out. But there's more people, as we're about to find out here in just a second. So we're going to go ahead and revert back to the video and let the narrator talk to you a little more.
You got the Rambos, you got Victor Wynette, and in 2010... William Ferris was arrested in Virginia for molesting children. The problem with the case is we don't know if she went directly to the store or not. She had a friend who lived on the street on the other side. And back in 1984, all this was open. There wasn't any fences. She could have left the house, walked this way, going to her friend's house. Now, her friend that day wasn't at home, which she was not aware of. But if she would have walked this way, there was a house back here, and there was no fences. This was all open. The house has been torn down. But in that house, back in 1984, William Ferris lived. William Ferris was arrested in 2010 in Virginia for child molestation. He's presently been sentenced to life. He's in a prison in Virginia. William Ferris denied in 2010 of knowing Christy. We re-interviewed him again, and he admitted to knowing Christy because his wife, back in 1984, babysat Christy's best friend. So he made statements according to his wife that when Christy and her friend, I'm not going to mention her friend's name, were together playing, he said, one of these days, one of these girls is going to disappear. After Christy disappeared, he made a statement that they'll never find her, that she's off of Alligator Alley.
William Ferris worked for the city of West Palm and moved to Virginia within a year after the murder of her disappearance of Christy.
What the hell is Alligator Alley? Is that his clever way of saying that he threw her in a swamp somewhere to get devoured by alligators?
So actually, no. Alligator Alley is a real thing. That would be the stretch of I-75 that runs east and west. Because I-75 is known to be north and south, but in this particular situation, it's east and west. It connects basically to the other side of the state of Florida on the south end, like toward Miami. And there's also another section of Alligator Alley that's 41, Highway 41, that crosses through the Everglades. There's a large population of alligators down there, Florida panthers, all kinds of Florida wildlife down there. Basically, you don't want to be walking down this highway late at night by yourself.
All right, I'll know to avoid that area of the U.S. then. Like, damn.
Yeah, this is a rough state. Yeah, getting to this point here, yeah, like, so I don't necessarily think he's a suspect. This particular gentleman, William Ferris, one of the reasons why is I think that this was all speculation on his end. Basically, just like any other person who lives in the neighborhood, two little girls playing by themselves. One of these girls is going to get kidnapped, and one of these girls is going to get kidnapped, and something real bad is going to happen to them. You know, kind of, in a way, a concerned parent type situation. Although I use that term loosely, especially considering, you know, what he would be charged with later on down the line. But I just think it was purely coincidental on the part of William Ferris that, you know, he would assume this. Yeah, and it's coincidental he moved to Virginia shortly after. I don't think he would have been a key suspect in this case. I mean, wouldn't you agree?
I would definitely agree with that. But I would also say that, you know, given his later history of sexual misconduct with children, that he couldn't necessarily be ruled out definitively.
Oh, sure.
Until there was some sort of evidence that could rule him out definitively. You know, I do think that what's-his-face with the confusing last name, what is it?
Wynette.
Wynette, yeah. The spelled weird. But Wynette, I think he is probably the most promising suspect, but this guy also kind of, you know, is up there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it makes sense. I mean, you can't necessarily rule anybody out unless you can absolutely 100% prove that they had nothing to do with this. Which in itself, you know, even though they may be publicly ruled out in the court of public opinion, I'm sure still with the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office within the rank and file, they probably still consider the Rambo brothers as persons of interest.
As well they should, given their history with people, you know, close to Christie. And the fact that Christie had literally been to their home and had allegedly been seen, you know, taking money from them. Mm-hmm. I mean, honestly, I think that it's, you know, a pretty high possibility that she may have been being molested by these men.
Right.
But I'm about 50-50 split as to whether or not they had anything to do with her disappearance, you know? Like, for all we know, they just wanted to keep on molesting her and were probably a little bit bummed out when she disappeared.
In a way, Ferris was right. Something bad did happen to one of these girls. Whether or not the suspect took her to Alligator Alley, you know, that could be open to debate. Because, I mean, Alligator Alley at the time wasn't even the only dumping ground in South Florida. There's plenty of places to dump a body at down in South Florida. But, and don't ask me how I know that. but, like, there could be a lot of rumors, a lot of innuendos about what happened in this case. But here's the fact right here. Here's what we know. We have an 8-year-old girl that just disappeared out of nowhere. And she still hasn't been found 35 years later. No solid tips have come in. The only thing they can rely on is a cast of characters of persons of interest. That's all we got right now. We don't have physical evidence. We don't have hard evidence. We don't even have hard witnesses because all of it is alleged. Even after this video was released to the general public, a big lead came in. They followed up on it. Law enforcement were quick to act. There was even a press conference regarding this dig that was about to happen behind somebody's house. Well, at the end of the day, yeah, I mean, it was big news. And in fact, you know, Jenny even did a press conference outside the sheriff's office right across from the Belk's General Store. And unfortunately, all they found were animal bones in that backyard because there was a new speculation that Christie was playing around in somebody's yard and she may have fell into the septic tank. They're saying now she wasn't murdered after all. This girl may have actually gotten herself into a bit of an entanglement that she was not able to get herself out of.
What?
Well, you know something though, Gwen. It does in a way make sense though. Like there are angles where this could be a possibility that this actually could have been one big accident, but she's not been found. Like she may have went down in some kind of ditch where, you know, there was some kind of like burrowed hole or something. She couldn't get out of the hole or something like that. Or, yeah, she ran onto a septic tank, fell right into it, and couldn't get out. May have died on impact falling down, although they're not really that deep in Florida. But, like, well, you know.
I'll be damned. It's like the owl theory and the staircase all over again.
Mm-hmm. And I know I'm kind of jumping ahead on this, but, like, I have to mention that because, you know, there was that theory that she may have fell in the damn septic tank. And a human being can fit, no matter how big you are, you can fit in a septic tank. Let's take a look at one episode that we're going to be running here in the future, Septic Tank Sam out of Canada. I mean, the guy's body was found in a septic tank. It was left in a septic tank to be concealed because he was murdered. And yeah, like it's amazing how we go from, oh, this girl was absolutely murdered to, this could have actually been an accident. This may have not been something intentional. Although because of a result of this speculation that had been going on all these years, we were able to clear the neighborhood of two child predators. We were able to get one predator off the street. And we were also able to eradicate another one who was lurking around, you know, Palm Beach County. So, like, either way, doesn't matter how this case's outcome is, there was some good done in this situation. There was good done in this case. There was, and I really love the fact that people got involved quickly in Christie's case, you know, for two whole weeks. The sheriff's office, the police station, FBI, they had cadaver dogs go going all through the woods. They had a group of volunteers running a phone bank, taking tips, making sure that they were getting all the information that they could get, fill them books up. There was an organization down in South Florida called Child Keepers. They were posting missing children's flyers all over South Florida. And then it went from just to South Florida to the entire state of Florida. And before you know it, Christy's face was appearing on milk cartons in Idaho. Like, her case is one of the most high-profile Florida cases ever when it comes to missing children. Right next to Adam Walsh, right next to Tiffany Sessions. This was one of the biggest breakthrough cases when it came to children missing. Anyways, but yeah, so with that being said, you know, Christy's case got a lot of traction early on. And, you know, a lot of people were talking about this case for years. In fact, I do have a friend who lives in South Florida. Her mom used to mention this case to her quite a bit, actually, when she was a kid. She'd go wandering out, and she's like, you keep on wandering out there like that, you're going to end up like that Christy kid up in Palm Beach. Or you're going to end up like Adam Walsh. You know, she would try to scare her kids into not being by themselves. And I'm sure this was probably common among other parents as well. For sake of reasoning and respect, I'm sure Jenny probably doesn't necessarily appreciate that a whole lot. You know, her kid being compared to other, you know, unfortunate victims and stuff like that, and being used as an example to other children, which is sad. This should never have happened. This case should never have happened. And
you can say that about so many cases.
Yeah. You're damn right. I mean, there are a lot of cases out there that should not have happened. But here we are, sitting here behind two mics, talking about when we shouldn't even be doing this. We shouldn't have to do this, but we're doing it. Because, you know, it's raising awareness that our children need to be protected at all costs. We need to be taking care of our kids. And I'm not taking anything away from Jenny, because I'm sure Jenny was a fantastic mother. She made sure that her kids were taken care of. In fact, I mean, I can tell, you know, in Jenny's voice about how broken up she is about this, that she really loved her daughter, cared for her daughter. You know, it's not one of those regular cases where a kid just ran away because the home life was awful. This was legitimate love. Like this, yeah, this should have never happened. And as we wrap up this documentary here, you're going to hear a little more about that from Christy's mom. And you're going to hear a lot of emotion coming from not just Christy's mom. You're going to hear it from Detective Springer as well. You have to keep in mind, Detective Springer was the first sheriff's detective working this case. One of the first original. And he's got to have some kind of emotional attachment at this point. Like, he probably feels like this was his own daughter that was kidnapped and possibly murdered. I don't blame him for feeling that way. I really don't. So we're going to go ahead and play the rest of this documentary, and then we'll offer some more thoughts, and then we'll go from there. So here we go. We'll go ahead and finish it up.
It's discouraging when you can't come up with leads and you can't find out what happened to her. Because when you look at Jenny and you have to place yourself in the idea of her daughter left home in 1984, and to this day she does not know what happened to her. Jenny has moved back into the house and has lived in the house that she lived in 1984, hoping that if Christy ever came back, she'd know where to go home to. This, I'm hoping, goes out nationwide, and maybe somebody might remember something that stood out in their mind back then, a neighbor who up and moved right away, changed cars, shaved their beard, got their hair cut, changed their appearance, you know, did something that, you know, really stood out to them. I mean, you may think, well, I'm protecting somebody, but you have to realize that whoever you're protecting really doesn't deserve to be protected. I mean, this person has deprived and taken somebody and deprived Jenny of watching her daughter grow up, her daughter get married, have kids, have a family, have grandkids. She's deprived Jenny of that. And then when you really think about it, she's deprived Christy of living a life of going to school, graduating high school, going to college, getting married, having kids. I mean, this person is and I used this before and I'll use it again, and you can cut it out. It's a special kind of piece because they have really destroyed not only Christie's life, but her mother's and her sister's life. And they've gone on with their life and enjoyed all this that they've deprived them of. And it's really not fair. I mean, it's really not. And I mean, and if you want to keep concealing this person and lying for him and covering for him and thinking that you're doing the right thing, you're not. You're no better than that piece because you're helping destroy Jenny's life and Allison's life because their life has been basically destroyed because of this one act by some perverted person.
She's born just a ray of sunshine. She was so sweet, so tiny, and just always such a good baby and smiling. Everybody loved her. Bright, lovely. A little mischief, but a lot of fun to be around.
And we live. And I'm going to stop it right there. God, that's hard to watch. I mean, you could tell the emotion running through Detective Springer and Jenny in this particular documentary, couldn't you?
I really enjoyed that he was able to call the person a piece of shit.
Yeah, me too.
Like, I love me a ballsy cop who just, like, is very blunt and puts it out there like that, honestly.
Oh, absolutely. Same here. I mean, I agree. I do. I mean, yeah, but it definitely goes to show you like how emotionally attached this man is to Christie's case. I mean,
absolutely.
It's really one of those sad cases that this one gets me, especially when I see that final part where Jenny's talking about, you know, her as a kid, you know, the ray of sunshine who was always smiling. That's just upsetting. And whoever did this to her, if she was murdered, just like Detective Springer said, they're a real piece of shit. And if there's somebody who knows something who's protecting this person, they're no better than that piece of shit. So, like, this is just awful. I mean, and especially, who would want to protect a child murderer of all people?
Right,
If you want to protect a child murderer, you really need your priorities straightened out.
Yeah,
I mean,
you've got some issues. You got some serious issues. Like, therapy might not touch that. It'll scratch the surface, but, like, good God.
Yeah, exactly. And I want to offer some footnotes before we wrap this up because, you know, this is, like I was just mentioning before we closed out the documentary, this case has received attention, quite a bit of it, especially in the 80s, to where, you know, she was on missing children's posters all around the country, she was on milk cartons. Her case has been featured on America's Most Wanted. And so, you know, we're talking about her case, and we briefly mentioned Tammy Belanger's case as well. And the thing is that, you know, both of these girls, in fact, let's just go ahead and say it, all of the girls and even little boys that go missing out there, they don't deserve that crap. They have, or they had a life ahead of them. They had yet to fulfill their dreams, their goals, their aspirations. They didn't even have all that. They were innocent people who didn't even babies. They didn't have all this. This was all innocence to them. They didn't know better. Whoever killed this girl or was responsible for her disappearance or Tammy's or anyone else who you probably find on any National Missing Children's website that was been abducted, they've been deprived of a decent childhood where, you know, they go through the motions of life of, you know, graduating high school, graduating college, experiencing a love life. I mean, all of these things, getting a brand new car, stuff like that, owning their own house, like
having children,
especially, although that one was not on the top of my list, though, unfortunately.
I mean, but you gotta figure at this point, Christie would be what, in her 40s by now?
Yeah. Oh yeah. She was born in 1976. So
yeah,
she'd be,
if she'd lived, she would have easily given her mother some grandchildren, you know, barring complications, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This monster who potentially robbed Christie of her future also robbed Jenny of hers by default.
you know, and I'm even like looking at Christy's pictures right now, and it's like, it's real sad. I mean, that this little girl, all smiles, and you know, she looks like she loved her life, and someone took it from her. I feel so bad for Jenny because she didn't get an opportunity to see her daughter grow up, all this stuff, and went through all of this, you know, having to do numerous television interviews and radio interviews and stuff like that. And, you know, she had her issues. No mother should ever have to go through this. No father like John Walsh or, you know, or Mark Class. They should have never had to went through their children disappearing and eventually being murdered.
At the very least, if somebody listening to this knows something, even if, like, you know, it's your parent or your uncle or your friend's parent or something along those lines, a grandparent even at this point, God's sake, just please give this family the closure that they so rightfully deserve, and please just say something.
Absolutely. Completely agree. On that note, guys, we want to go ahead and close this episode out. This one definitely was very emotional. Definitely compared to our last episode together when we were just talking about, you know, unidentified people. We're actually talking about people who, well, I mean, not taking away from anything from the unidentified, but we're talking about children who disappeared, and it's just a very unfortunate situation, and we hope that some kind of resolution can eventually come to these cases. Yeah, it might be a little bit of a long shot, but to be quite honest, is anything really a long shot if we all work together and get these things rolling? A lot of these cold cases from 30, 40, 50 years ago, once we thought they were unsolvable, well, shit, they're being solved left and right, and it's all thanks to DNA technology. But in this case, we don't have that, so we have to rely on other methods. But still, don't count them out just yet. Maybe perhaps one day we'll find them. But on that note, if you do have any information whatsoever on Christy Luna's case, Marjorie Christina Luna, you are urged to contact the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office. Their phone number is 561-688-4013. Once again, 561-688-4013. Additionally, for Tammy Lynn Belanger's case out of Exeter, New Hampshire, if you know anything about her case, we urge you to contact the Exeter Police Department at 603-772-1212. Again, that's 603-772-1212. Now, because both of these missing persons are both children, they are on the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children's website, and their cases are also being handled by NCMEC. So if you have any information or you want to remain anonymous, contact the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children at 1-800-THE-LOST. That's 1-800-THE-LOST. But with that being said, yeah, this was a really good episode, what do you think?
Absolutely. I am very grateful that you had me on, despite the heavy subject matter. You know, I mean, we always manage to have a good time when we're doing these episodes, even when it is, you know, fairly emotional stuff.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I really think that talking about cases involving children, it's really difficult. For me, it can be hard to talk about, but someone's got to do it, right?
Exactly, you know, and cold cases and missing persons cases especially, like, those specific departments, those specific areas in police departments are often underfunded and can't do a lot of the work that they need to do to accomplish the goals that they want to accomplish. And so really, it's up to the general public in a lot of these instances to just, you know, speak out and say something. And I'm really glad, for one, to be a part of that, but be a part of what you're doing here.
Oh, thank you. And actually, yeah, I mean, our next episode, we're going to be talking about an Oregon case. It's going to be about Joan Hall. out of Warrenton, Oregon. And we hope that our listeners will be able to stay tuned for that. We'll be talking about her quite a bit. In fact, there was a YouTuber, and, you know, granted, I'm not necessarily going to, you know, call him out on here by name, because I was once a YouTuber too, but he really fucked up the episode that he covered on her, to the point where Joan Hall's advocate called him out on numerous platforms and even did a Facebook Live and embarrassed the shit out of him. And yeah, so she's hoping that I can fix that. Although I had planned to do Joan Hall's case for a long time, I'm glad we're finally getting there, and she's going to help me out with this. So I'm excited to be doing that. And we might even have a special third guest host with us on this episode of From the Vault. So we hope you'll stay with us for that next episode. And then pretty soon, Nick will have an exciting episode on the Amy Mahalovic case. That's one you're not going to want to miss. So, Gwen, once again, thank you for joining me on this episode of From the Vault. We hope to have you again soon. And yeah, and we'll go from there, folks. So thank you for joining us again on another episode, and we'll see you on the next one.